Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast, and a happy 2019. I'm Chelsea Damon, and we're back for a new year of great shows with fantastic guests. And today we have Sean McFate back on the show. He was on a while back, and he has a new book that is coming out on the 22nd of January, so do keep a lookout for The New Rules of War, Victory in the Age of Durable Disorder. So welcome back to the Loopcast, Sean.
Thanks, Chelsea. It's great to be back.
For our listeners, Dr. McFate is an author, as we've already established, and he's also an expert in foreign policy and national security strategy. He's had experience in the U.S. Army in the 82nd Airborne Division. He also was a private military contractor, and he is also a professor of strategy at the National Defense University and Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. He has a number of books, including academic type, policy type books, and then he has some really great fiction books that incorporate his experiences. One of them is Shadow War and Deep Black, and it's the Tom Locke series. So depending on your type of reading that you like to do, Sean has many books available. So we're going to talk about The New Rules of War, and this book is great. I had a chance to read it before it came out, so I feel very lucky. Thank you for getting your book to us, Sean. And I first want to just start off and discuss what drove you to write this book, because there's a lot of controversial ideas, and I was reading it and I loved it because I know it's going to really sit well with some people, and other people it's going to push their buttons and they're probably going to be going, what is this man talking about? So tell us your reasons for writing this great new book.
This book has actually sort of been a long time in making, several years. And it really was about a question, and the question is this, is why has America stopped winning wars? You know, the last time we decisively won a war, the world ran on vacuum tubes, is World War II. And since then, the U.S. has lost, or not won, either way, you know, Korea, Vietnam, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, and several other conflicts. And it's not just the United States, it's the West. I mean, France lost in Indochina and Algeria. Great Britain has lost. The Soviets lost in Afghanistan. And the question is, what does it mean if the West can no longer win wars? Why is that? And then how do we reverse that? Can we reverse that? Can we actually win wars again? A lot of people, I think, have given up and say that the future wars are forever wars, which is an unsatisfactory answer for me, so I wrote this book.
And that's really important because there are so many implications to continuing the way we have done warfare for so long. And many people, I'm sure, just observing the current conflicts and past conflicts have seen so many changes in how conflicts are being fought nowadays. So let's talk about the implications for that as we transition into your rules for military engagement that you have in your book.
Yeah, so I answer the question, like, why have we continued to fail? And the answer are 10 sort of new rules or principles of 21st century warfare that if you follow these rules, you can win. And I say that with confidence because others have followed these rules. These rules, you know, the war has moved on. Everybody else has moved on except for the U.S. And what this book tries to do is put America at the head of the herd again. But to the conventional warrior, this will make their head explode.
Yes, and I can completely see that because when I was reading parts of the book, I was just thinking about certain military people that I've come across that they would probably be saying, oh my God, what are we talking about? Because there is this tradition that we've had for so many years of doing things the same way and investing billions of dollars in the same types of technologies. So let's look at these 10 rules and tease them all out. So the first one, which I find very, very straight to the point, is that conventional war is dead. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, so this is right off the bat. I sort of nail my colors to the mast and say conventional war is dead, which will make half the Pentagon explode. Literally, it will make half the Pentagon, if not more. Conventional war is our paradigm of warfare. So when you ask people, like, well, what do you think about when you think about war? what they will describe to you is something that looks like conventional war. And it's, you know, they'll say, for example, it looks like World War II. You know, it's like nation state on nation state fighting a war of survival using industrial strength militaries, and the entire population has been mobilized for, you know, for patriotism to survive. It's World War II. And the problem is that, you know, and they fight using sort of, you know, military on military battles, and you win by killing the most enemy, taking the most territory, flying your flag over the enemy's capital, which is great, except that nobody fights the war that way anymore. There's nothing more unconventional than conventional war. And for 70 years, nobody has fought that way. Yet that's how we continue to spend billions of dollars creating an armed forces, you know, training it to fight a conventional war in an era when nobody's fought that way since 1945. And nobody will fight this way again. So the first thing I do is say conventional war is dead. And that is, that right there is sort of anathema to the traditional warrior.
And why don't you step us through the next step, that technology will not save us? Because, of course, right now we're in this world of technology. There's so many new products coming out and security used in technology and technology incorporated into fighter jets and so forth. So
The American way of war writ large has always featured technology. And we Americans love technology. And this goes back to our inventing roots in the 19th century, you know, Ford, the Wright brothers, Thomas Edison. This is a part of our culture writ large, and it also translates to military culture. So we put all our eggs in the technological basket. We're going to have the F-35, for example. The F-35 is a fighter jet. It costs more than Russia's GDP, right? Which is insane if you think of it. It costs $1.5 trillion for the whole program. And the measurement of any weapons utility is how much it gets used. And in two long wars, the F-35 flew exactly zero combat missions. It is the most obsolete, most expensive weapon in history, and we're buying a lot more of them. In fact, the last time there was a strategic dogfight was the Korean War, so why do we even need more fighter jets? I don't even know. But we love our technology. When you ask people to think about the future of war in the United States of America, what they usually articulate is World War II with better technology. They imagine like robot wars and AIs from science fiction, and they imagine like air-sea battles in the South China Sea that look like Midway with better technology. But in truth, technology, if there's one thing about modern war, is that technology is doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. For 70 years, we've seen low-tech Luddite forces beat high-tech advanced militaries. So if there's any lesson from the last 70 years of warfare, is that technology does not matter.
And one of the comments you make under this category of technology will not save us is that cyber is important, but not in the sense that most people perceive. And I was wondering if we could tease this out a bit.
Yeah, so I am not a Luddite. I think technology is important for warfare, but we overinvest in it. We should just take it off the altar of war and put it just on the floor. And I think we are investing in the wrong types of technology. So cyber is important, but all cyber does, it allows us actually to do old things in new ways. It allows us to do espionage in new ways, sabotage in new ways, theft in new ways, propaganda in new ways. It doesn't change warfare or much less war, as many people claim. Many people claim that, but it doesn't. It just allows us to do, you know, old things in new ways. That's it.
And your third category is this idea that there's no such thing as war or peace, and both war and peace coexist always. And I love this because it really makes a lot of sense to me and the things I've studied. So let's discuss this.
Yeah. I mean, this is the... So these 10 rules, some are ancient, some are new. This is an ancient one, right? This is an idea that, you know, we have an on-off switch for war. We think that, you know, war happens when peace fails and you formally declare war. Think about the U.S. Civil War. You formally declare war. The militaries go at it. This is conventional war. And then when one side capitulates, you go to peace. You sign a peace treaty. And then people look around like, why won't the Taliban cooperate with us and just do this? Why won't China cooperate with us and just do this? The truth is that war and peace, there's no such thing as war or peace. There's only war and peace. We've created this category of war or peace, and others exploit that for strategic advantage. That's what China is doing to us right now in the South China Sea. They are winning. They're winning islands and making islands. And they don't have a single aircraft carrier, which blows our Navy's mind. Like, how could you? It's not fair. You can't take an island without an aircraft carrier. But what they do is they do something right up to the brink of what war is. We freak out. They stop, right short of war. But they keep what they kill. They don't give it all back. And they just do this incrementally. And this is how they're winning the South China Sea. They're not doing it like World War II conventional war. They're doing it other ways. They're doing it by exploiting our false notions of war versus peace. They get in between war and peace and take advantage of it.
So considering that, and I'm sure there's many other examples that even I can think of besides China, would that say that we're always in a state of emergency in a sense, because we're always combating an adversary, maybe not so much in the strategic sense of on a battlefield, but within the greater scheme of things?
Well, we've done this before. We've just forgotten. So this is what the Cold War was, right? I mean, the Cold War is, how do you have a strategic adversary and you're moving against them and they're moving against you, but you can't let it go to all-out war? And so we all got very adept, the Soviets and the U.S., of playing in this gray area between war and peace. Playing is the wrong word. Fighting in this gray area between war and peace. And that's what we need to start doing again, because that's what Russia and China and several others are doing to us already.
So your next rule is about a term that we hear a lot about, winning hearts and minds. And you say hearts and minds do not matter. So let's talk about that.
Sure. What do you want to know? It's very controversial.
It is. At first, when I read that section of just, I saw the title, number four, hearts and minds do not matter. And I had this moment of, what? But when I started reading more, it made a lot of sense. So why don't you tease out for our listeners what you mean by that and why?
Yeah. So we learned during the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, we learned about this thing called counterinsurgency strategy. And this was David Petraeus trying to shift the U.S. military to fighting insurgency using tools of, frankly, of colonial powers, like David Galula. And the logic of the strategy was this, is that, you know, people's hearts and minds matter, and that's how you win wars against insurgencies and terrorists. You win over the population, win the war. Now, that briefs well in D.C. and Congress. But the fact is, he lost both Iraq and Afghanistan because this strategy was a failure. It was a complete failure. I don't know why he's feted today. I mean, we don't fet General Westmoreland for losing Vietnam, but Petraeus is, you know, he's beloved. And the reason why the strategy failed, and nobody seems to want to analyze this, and this book does, is because the underlying logic of counterinsurgency, of winning hearts and minds, is bribing people. It assumes that we can bribe people for their loyalty, but we can't. So imagine this. Imagine China goes to Detroit and says, we will give you free healthcare, free education, build you a new football stadium, and all you got to do is be a communist. Well, what are people in Detroit going to do? They will take China's stuff, but they're not going to become communist. They won't give their allegiance. And that's why COIN did not work for the U.S. in Iraq or Afghanistan. And it won't work anyplace else, too. Ultimately, winning hearts and minds does not win wars. It briefs well to democracies. We like to think that, social contract theory, that if the state provides services, the people will be loyal to the state. But that's not how most places in the world work. That may be how the U.S. works, but our mirroring of that to other people will fail. So actually, there are COIN strategies that work, but they're quite brutal and awful.
what would you recommend versus winning hearts and minds? Or is there really anything that will help? Or is this just a vicious circle?
Well, I think the first thing is to recognize that counterinsurgency as practiced by the United States of America is a complete failure. Winning hearts and minds, you know, kind-hearted people end up doing more harm in war than not. You know, trying to win hearts and minds, all you do is muddle and elongate conflicts. You don't resolve them, and that prolongs human suffering. So the first thing to do is stop. You know, it's like the first rule of hole digging is to stop digging yourself into a hole. So we must stop counterinsurgency. Second of all is we have to decide, you know, what does work in insurgency, and are we willing to do that? So what works in insurgency is actually quite horrible. It is brutal force. It is brutal coercion, whether it's what Rome did to Judea in 68 AD, or what the U.S. did to the Philippines in the beginning of the 20th century, or what the what Russia did to Chechnya in 1999, or what Sri Lanka did to the LTTE in 2009 in Sri Lanka. The one thing that separates these successful counterinsurgencies campaigns is that they are human rights catastrophes, but they did compel the insurgency to go away or die. There are three ways to deal with the insurgency. One is you could beat it to death, collateral damage be damned, which is what I was just talking about. A second way you can do it is you can do the export model, which is where you take the insurgent population and you export it and spread it around the world. So this is what what Stalin did to the Chechens in 1943, 1944. They were uprising against the Soviet Union during World War II. He said, okay, fine. He took them and forcibly exported them across the 11 time zones of the Soviet Union so that they would become a minority in somebody else's homeland, and that defanged the insurgency. Or the third way you can do it is you can do what China's doing in Tibet. You do an import model, which is you take a bullet train, and every day it dumps off more and more Han Chinese into Tibet, and so that the Tibetans become a minority in their own homeland. Or the most successful way of all is you combine all three of these strategies of coercion, export, and import, which is what the United States of America did as it settled the West in the late 19th century. It waged genocide against the Indians, it imported white settlers and took over their lands, and it exported Indians off of their homeland into other reservations far, far away from them. And that's how, and the counterinsurgency of the West in the 19th century was brutal, awful, unfair, but it was effective.
So listening to all this, it makes complete sense. But when you also think about it from a modern point of view, looking at the history of American Indians here in the States, you sit here and you think, oh my God, this is against American values and democracy and
that's right,
human rights. So how do we stomach the reality of what you need to do versus...
You're absolutely right. I mean, being horrible. So Chelsea, my rules are not prescriptive. They're not like saying we should necessarily do all these things, but they're saying, like, if you want to win wars, these are things you should consider doing. Rule four, I don't advocate doing these things. So I advocate personally, like, let's not do counterinsurgency anymore. The idea that we can change somebody else's country's internal dynamics as an external partner is a little, you know, needs some humility. And I think when you think about military strategy, or strategy writ large, it has to, you know, it has to be acceptable to the American people, and it has to be feasible, like it works. So I've explained what is feasible in counterinsurgency. Is it acceptable to the American people? I would hope not. The bigger point of this rule is that counterinsurgency, as we learned it in 2009, the Petraeus model, that's all like kittens, rainbows, and unicorns. It doesn't really exist. And the first thing we have to do is disband that from our strategic repertoire.
Another point that you touch on in the hearts and minds section is ideology and hypocrisy, which reading that hit a lot of strong points. You mentioned the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the U.S. relations with them. So let's discuss this a bit, especially lately with everything that's happened with Saudi Arabia and the U.S.
Yeah, so this has always been a problem. So like since the Truman Doctrine, the U.S. has said one of our pillars of our national security strategy, our foreign policy, is a promotion of democracy. But in practice, there's a lot of hypocrisy in that. We're going to invade Saddam Hussein because he's not a democracy, and you know, may have WMD, but we're going to be okay with Saudi Arabia, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, etc. And what this looks like to the external world, as you can imagine, is just, you know, you have no credibility at this point. So the thing that I would advocate is like we need to be consistent. And I think removing ideology from our national security strategy to be a little bit more realpolitik would go a long way to establish credibility. Because in international relations, credibility is almost everything. And if you have none of it, it's hard to... I mean, you have the stick, right? The United States has the stick and it has some carrots, but ultimately what it really needs is credibility.
Very much so. And number five is the best weapons do not fire bullets.
Yeah.
About that.
Well, anybody who's paying attention to the Mueller investigation knows what this means, right?
Yeah.
We have this idea that, you know, again, conventional warfare, that firepower is supreme, right? And that's a conventional war, antiquated, fossil-y type, ossified thinking. In truth, the best weapons today don't fire bullets. So like in the Cold War, so we know about how, you know, Russia, et cetera, used, you know, social media campaigns to wage a strategic information campaign that was pretty successful, right? In the Cold War, if Russia, or the Soviet Union wanted to press back against NATO, what they would do is would have a huge military exercise on the border of, say, West Germany to scare the bejesus out of the NATO. And it worked. And of course, then, you know, NATO didn't know if was this a real attack? Was it a fake attack? Was it just a military exercise? It was hard to know. But today, when Putin wants to, you know, disunite Europe, which was always the goal of the Soviet Union, he doesn't do that. I mean, he has this thing called Zapad 18, but that's just a joke. What he does is he bombs civilians in Syria. And this creates a tidal wave of civilian refugees that hit the shores of Europe and creates an immigration crisis that ultimately ends up in the Brexit, that ultimately ends up in right-wing groups, political parties, reaching historical precedents in the post-World War II European order. We see like these far right-wing extremist parties rise in France and Germany and Italy and in Greece, everywhere. And Putin has done more by weaponizing refugees than by any sort of military fake invasion that the Soviets ever did. So, but the bottom line is that in today's modern world, the best weapons may not shoot bullets.
You also mentioned that all instruments of national power are basically fair game to be used. Could you discuss this?
Yeah, so when you talk about like grand strategy, you're talking about how do you harness all your instruments of power, not just the military ones. Of course, of diplomacy, you know, information, economics, you know, how can we use, you know, our fiscal trade policy to exert leverage on other countries? People say this all the time, like, oh, yeah, we understand all weapons are national, not just the military, it's all weapons of national power. That's what we do when we create the national security strategy. But in truth, we don't do that. You know, budgets are moral documents because they don't lie. And if you look at DOD's budget, it is huge compared to everybody else's. It's like the fiddler crab with that one big claw and a tiny, tiny small claw. That's what DOD is, right? So like we say this, but in practice, we are all about the military. When there's something out there that we don't like, we go to airstrikes first, you know, or drone strikes or something like that, right? And that doesn't really work very well in modern warfare. There are more cunning ways to get what you want. Basically, from this whole book, you know, the future of war is not World War II with better technology. the future of war is here now, and war is getting sneakier. It's going underground. It's becoming what I call it shadow wars. But this is, we are not, we're falling victim to it rather than mastering it.
And number six is mercenaries will return. And I loved this section because it hit home in a lot of the research I'm doing as well. And just looking at current and past, recent past conflicts, let's put it that way. So let's discuss this.
Sure. What do you want to know?
Well, I mean, you mentioned at the starting, you mentioned you look at Afghanistan and Iraq, and you discussed that over half the military personnel were contractors, which being in the D.C., Virginia, Maryland area, you hear so many people that are contractors that were in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the numbers are just staggering. So let's look at that and then how that transitions into mercenaries within different conflicts.
So, it's shocking to think about this, but over half of the U.S. personnel in our force structure in Iraq, over half were contracted, and over 70% were in Afghanistan. At the height of those wars, we were fighting war by contract, right? By comparison, during World War II, only 10% of the force was contracted. That's how much we've changed. And when I talk to foreign journalists, they sometimes ask me, well, in the future, do you think it's going to be 90%, 100%? And the answer is, yeah, I do. We already have Eric Prince out there who's saying we should replace all troops in Afghanistan by mercenaries, preferably his mercenaries. Eric Prince was the founder of Blackwater, as your listeners probably know. And Donald Trump is sympathetic to this. And now that General Kelly, General McMaster, Mr. /General Mattis have left, I think that, you know, we might be seeing a mercenary option for Afghanistan. We have an ex-general on Fox say that contractors should replace all troops in Syria. We're moving toward this direction. But more importantly, what the U.S.'s over-reliance of contractors in Iraq, well, first of all, let me go back. Most of those contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan were not mercenaries. They were just unarmed contractors, you know, cooking food, repairing trucks, stuff like that. Only 15% of them would be considered mercenaries or armed, but that 15% has been enough to resuscitate the mercenary trade worldwide, because when the U.S. let go of those contracts, a lot of those guys and some gals went elsewhere looking for new clients, including Eric Prince, whose new boss is Beijing. And he's a conflict of interest there for Afghanistan, as you can imagine. So we're seeing now a global mercenary trend that is completely ignored in United States media, and it's becoming a significant international security threat, because for-profit warfare is completely different strategically than conventional war, the wars that we grew up learning and watching about.
And for those that listen that might not understand the benefits or the negatives of using, let's say, within the U.S. military contractors, maybe you could tease that out a bit and then also tell us the benefits and the negatives, which you've touched on a little bit right now, of mercenaries or even private military contractors.
Sure. And so just for the sake of transparency, I myself was in this industry. So I was a paratrooper in the U.S. Army for many years. I got out. And I was a private military contractor, mostly in Africa and Eastern Europe and not in Afghanistan, Iraq. But I was in this world for several years. There's a lot of benefits to contractors. And so I'm not anti-contractor. I just want to be smart in how we use contractors. Contractors allow us to do a lot of things that we, you know, they can be more efficient, more effective, and they are cheaper than using the U.S. military in many cases. They are innovative in their strategies. They're also not sort of beholden to bureaucratic infighting and turf wars. And they're very cost effective. And there's certain tasks that they can do better, I think, than the military can, like security force assistance, police work, stuff like that. We still have a lot of problems with impunity, accountability, transparency, that I think that, and I suggest ways to get around that in the book. But they're basically augmenting the U.S. military overseas. Mercenaries are different. Mercenaries are like private armies. And they could either be they could be large private armies or they could be small squads. But we've seen them proliferate over the last, say, 4 years. So the last 4 years, for example, we had Nigeria secretly hiring mercenaries to kill Boko Haram, which is that Islamic terrorist group that abducted some 200-300 schoolgirls to rape them. And the Nigerian military, which is not a weak military, for 6 years could not deal with Boko Haram. They secretly hired mercenaries to help them, and they cleared Boko Haram out of Nigeria within weeks, right? And these mercenaries, when they showed up, they weren't lone guys with Kalashnikovs. They showed up with attack helicopters and like special forces teams that were very good. And they just went after the terrorists. And people thought, like, maybe we should do that for Syria, you know, or maybe have a bounty system. We've also seen mercenaries in Syria, in Iraq, in Ukraine, in Yemen. We've seen American mercenaries, ex-Special Forces Green Berets and ex-SEALs become assassination squads for a Middle East monarchy in Yemen. So mercenarism is on the rise. Mercenaries are proliferating, but always in the shadows.
I'm thinking about that because, like you said, a lot of people that end up joining companies or teams of mercenaries do have military background because they're trained, they can put it to use. It's another way of, you know, using their skills. Is this something as a country, say America, that we should be worrying about, that we're training people that potentially down the line might join a mercenary and fight for whoever, even potentially an enemy per se?
Well, I'm sure we should worry about it, but I don't think there's much we can do. It's like saying, should we, you know, can you control U.S. Air Force pilots getting out and flying for Delta Airlines, right? you really can't. Now, being a mercenary is probably illegal, although it's questionable because you have American citizens who join, for example, the Israeli Defense Force. Are they mercenary? Are they not? That's a good question, you know. Some are dual citizens, so that's probably not a problem, but you know, and at the end of the day, who's going to go into Yemen and arrest all those mercenaries, right? I mean, is it the Marine Corps going to do it? No. Is it going to be the United Nations? No, of course not. So any law against mercenaries, this is why international law can't fix this problem, is that international law, first of all, is weak. And second of all, international law enforcement in this particular area is almost impossible because mercenaries can shoot your law enforcement dead. You know, so they resist legal, you know, regulation. So I don't really know if we can stop this trend at all. I think, but you know, mercenaries are the second oldest profession, and they've only been off international relations for 150 years, which is not long in human history. And there were the fact that they're returning now in force and seems to be an unstoppable trend really should not surprise us too much if you look at the scope of human history.
New types of world powers will rule. That is rule number 7 in your book. And why don't we talk about the different type of world powers that you are talking about and how they apply to conflict?
Well, sure. So when we think about, you know, what we know usually comes from like social studies class in 7th grade, right? Unless you're like a graduate student in this field, you know, we think of powers as being states. But that's also only a recent thing in human history. Most states right now are retreating. And if there's like 190 so states in the world, 195, depending who you count, the vast majority of them are failing and fragile states. When we think of states, we only think of usually the top 25, which is like North America, West Europe, East Asia, and some other countries. But the vast majority of states in the world are states in name only. They're more like counties. They try to maintain their bridges, collect some local taxes, but they don't really have much control over who comes through their borders or who has what. In actuality, like the Fortune 500 has more power in the world than most states. They're also very rich people. Did you know that 62 people in the world own half of the world's wealth.
Mm.
62 people. That's you can put all those people onto a bus. Mm-hmm. You know, and now with the advent of mercenaries, they can be armed and dangerous too. And so what we're going to see now in the future is private, you know, multinational corporations, very rich people, random billionaires, oligarchs, they're going to fight and defend for what they have. And if they can use mercenaries in the shadows to do so, I think they will. There's a natural law of supply and demand there. And other, we're also seeing things like terrorists who also hire mercenaries and drug lords. You know, the states of Latin America, for example, are sort of a case in point. Those states are what we call narco states. A lot of them are narco states, like Salvador. They're sort of states in name only. They don't rule war. They're loot for war. They're booty in war. And other groups fight for states than what they have. So you have cartels, which are more powerful than states, better armed than states, and, you know, have divvied up Latin America as they see fit. So we're actually already seeing this in parts of the world, like Latin America and Africa, parts of South Asia. We're seeing non-state actors becoming more powerful than states, and this creates the possibility of the eighth rule, which is wars without states. In the future, there will be wars without states, and this is unthinkable to the conventional Pentagon mind. But already we're starting to see it with, like, cartel wars in Latin America, and that's been going on for at least two decades, if not much longer.
And especially if you think about how, say, the Pentagon looks at war, it's this very traditional sense of your adversary is another state or multiple states, as in World War I or II. And so this idea of you're fighting something that's not a state, and yes, we've seen that with some small terrorist groups and insurgent groups, but a proliferation of that, I'm sure, could make heads spin in the Pentagon, because the conventional way of doing things is completely flipped upside down.
It is. And let's not forget that, I'm being very honest here, is that the Pentagon and the thinking that emanates from the Pentagon lost Iraq and lost Afghanistan because they could not think about fighting a war against a non-state actor. There are ways to fight non-state actors. They couldn't do it. I mean, they went from a conventional approach, which is what they took early on in the war. Well, first of all, they thought, for some strange reason, that this, you know, Rumsfeld said Iraq would be over in days, weeks, and certainly not months, is what he said in 2002 or 2003. And then when it did take longer than that, the military tried conventional approaches. It failed. They pivoted to coin. That failed. They pivoted to a surge, thinking that would succeed. That failed. And now they said, they threw up their hands and saying, we're done with small wars. We're going to think about near peer powers. We're going to focus on China and Russia, which is traditionally what the military does when it's defeated. It's just like, we're going to, you know, think about, you know, a symmetrical power, like, you know, and this is what we did in 1976 after the failed Vietnam War. We said, well, we need to focus on the Soviet Union. Back then we had an enemy. Today we don't. So, I mean, we have Russia, we have China, but it's a question about, you know, is it a self-fulfilling prophecy if we declare China the enemy and treat it like it's an enemy combatant? So that's, I mean, it gets back to my rule. There's no war or peace. There's war and peace. We have to be a bit more nuanced, but we've sort of taken this position that China is the enemy now.
And I think that's something important for listeners and readers to understand, that all these rules, in a sense, are one. They all work together in this big scheme of things. So you can see how each one transfers to the other or can be used with a different rule. So it's good to keep that in mind. And rule number 9 is shadow wars will dominate. So could you tell us first what you consider a shadow war versus an insurgency and what this means?
So it's a great question. So think of the Cold War, right? That war between the U.S. and the USSR was, in many ways, a hot war just beneath the surface. And that is sort of an example of shadow war. These are things that you're, you know, you look at Ukraine today. Let me back up a little bit. So we live, shadow war, Cold War is an example of that, but it's Cold War on steroids. We live in a global information age. And what that means strategically is that plausible deniability is more supreme than firepower. So plausible deniability matters more than firepower. And if you don't believe me, look at how Russia successfully captured much of eastern Ukraine and the Crimea. Their military, they have a big military. It's not like it was in the Soviet times. So it was certainly bigger than Ukraine's. They could have done a blitzkrieg into eastern Ukraine and just taken it outright with tanks and airplanes and conventional war. What Moscow did is they waged a shadow war using clandestine means, like Spetsnaz, which are their special forces, proxy militias, like the Donbass battalions, using mercenaries, lots of mercenaries, one called the Wagner Group, which is very powerful, using what they call little green men. These are soldiers who are Russian soldiers, but they have all their insignia stripped off of them. So they look like sort of like those little green men you see little boys play with, you know, those plastic ones. And this worked because when the U, you know, and in some ways it was a brilliant offense, terrible in some ways. Otherwise, it was brilliant because while the Kremlin was busy taking over their Crimea and eastern Ukraine, the world was debating, like, what's going on here? And how can the U.S. rally a global defense against, you know, in favor of Ukraine against Moscow when the basic facts of the conflict are in question? And that's what he did. That's what the Kremlin did. And by the time the tanks and the Navy destroyers showed up in Crimea and Sevastopol, it was already a fait accompli. It was already done. And this is the way of the future. If you want to take over stuff, you do it in the shadows. You don't do it sort of conventional war style, U.S. military style. War is going underground. It's going into the shadows. And we need to get smart and follow into the shadows and punch back. Otherwise, we're going to get our asses handed to us.
The idea of a shadow war, it's just so much more effective because first, your adversary or people watching it might not completely know all the wheels and cogs that are in motion because it's done so differently. And therefore, just trying to figure out what's happening in the starting can take so much longer than a conventional war where you know this is what's happening, this is what we do.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, what the Mueller probe is investigating is an element of Russia's shadow war against the U.S. I mean, why defeat the U.S.'s powerful military when you can manipulate its commander-in-chief, right? That's an example of shadow war. It's when you, in shadow wars, information is king. And so intelligence matters more than F-35s. You know, we need to invest in our intelligence agencies and others. That's a whole different question, like how we would do that. But, like, you know, things that give you plausible deniability, like special forces, mercenaries, other things, that those are the weapons of war that matter in the future. It's not nuclear war. It's not deterrence theory. It's mutually assured destruction. What good is that if you don't know who exactly attacked you? You know, think of like cyber war. So one of the things that makes cyber war so difficult is that it's a question of attribution. Like you get attacked by, you know, by some sort of cyber weapon, but you don't really know who shot that weapon at you. You can take guesses, but there's no sort of smoking gun. Shadow war is the same way. It manipulates, it's like epistemological warfare. It manipulates what you think you know, and a good shadow warrior can frame somebody else for their crimes. Does that make sense? They can make the U.S. go to war with Mexico or something by sort of doing a black flag operation or something like that. So, you know, it's like the Cold War, but on steroids because of the global information age that we live in.
Oh, yes. It's a brilliant strategy if you look at it from any side. You just think, yeah, that would work really well.
Yeah, and we're really slow in the uptake, which makes us really prime targets. And we're, in some ways, we are at a disadvantage because we are democracies. Now, obviously, I'm a pro-democracy, don't get me wrong. But in this case, regime change, if you have a competent strategist at the top of an autocracy, they can be a big threat to the U.S. because everything we do is in the open, it's messy. You know, our decision-making is pretty messy. We have divided government. We're seeing this today as we're at right now, our government shut down, right? It doesn't really happen in Beijing or in Moscow. There are autocracies, you know, but there are ways to fight shadow wars back. We have done this before. We have succeeded before. Sometimes we've succeeded in a very messy fashion. And the book explains how do we fight back as a democracy in the shadows without losing our soul?
And last but not least, we're at number 10, and I'll let you do the honors of telling our listeners what that is and how it fits in.
So number 10 is called Victory is Fungible. And what this means is that there are many ways to win. So when we think of, when the conventional warrior thinks of victory, we generally think of, like, think about ISIS right now. We killed a lot of ISIS. We've taken over all the territory they've seized. We've taken, you know, our flags are flying over Mosul and probably Raqqa, and that should be victory, right? But that's not how war is fought today. You can do all those things and still lose the war. This is what Israel learned in the 2006 war against Hezbollah. They, by old rules of war, they succeeded, yet they lost the war because war has moved on. Same for us. So the key to this is knowing, you know, if you don't understand how to achieve victory, then you cannot formulate a strategy to do so. And victory today means this. There's many ways to win, many ways to lose. Sometimes your enemy, all they've got to do to win is survive. All they've got to do, you know, as Kissinger once said, the guerrilla wins if he does not lose. The regular army, you know, the government loses if it does not win. There's many ways to win. There's many ways to lose. There are ways to win that don't even require a big military or a military at all. And this book explains some of those strategies. There are ways to win by weaponizing things like time. How do you weaponize the environment? And this is not new. This goes back to Sun Tzu's Art of War. So Victory is Fungible, the last rule of this book, explains what does winning look like for the 21st century. And then it assumes that the reader will someday, you know, become president of the United States of America and can make up for their own strategies. And there's ways for us to win.
And you have a great line in this section of the book where you say, victory belongs to the cunning, not the strong. And I loved that. It just hit home on many areas. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think the trick to winning today, and this is not new. It's certainly not a new idea of mine. This is a very ancient idea in the art of war. Again, going back to Sun Tzu, there's something called China's 36 stratagems that go back to the 3rd or 4th century BC. It's this, is that if you can trick, you know, well, who cares about, you know, how many tanks you have if you can manipulate the mind of the commander who deploys those tanks? If you can trick the enemy into giving up, if you can sap their will to fight, you can win. And maybe the best weapons of war don't shoot bullets. It's about strategic messaging. It's about messaging levers of power that make political decisions, that make strategic decisions rather than having to deal with the fight on the ground. In many ways, this is what the North Vietnamese did during the Vietnam War. When the U.S. is busy killing Vietnamese in the jungles of Vietnam, they were working with others, both in Vietnam and, you know, and you know, partners, to get American anti-war fervor going. So there are many ways to be sneaky about war to win that don't require a big military or a military at all.
So we've gone through your 10 different rules for war. After this, and hopefully our listeners will pick up this book and read it and digest all of the extra info you have. I mean, we're only touching on as much as we can in this talk. But what is it that you want readers and, more importantly, military policymakers to take away from this book? Because there are a lot of implications. There's a lot of amazing information in the book. Yet, as we said at the starting of the talk, there are things that are going to make some heads spin. So what is the takeaway that you'd like to see?
Well, the takeaway, first of all, I wrote this book for a mass audience. This is not a wonky book. It's not an academic book. It's undergirded by academic and real ideas. It's a rigorous book, but it's written like a magazine style of reading, because I want it to be read beyond Washington, D.C.'s Beltway. I want it to be read beyond the ivory tower. And the takeaways are this. One, the way we're fighting war right now is antiquated. It's like us going into World War I right now, still practicing Napoleonic horse tactics. Now, war has moved well beyond the way that our military conceives of warfare. And that puts us all at risk. We're in danger. We have the best soldier. We have the best troops, the best equipment, the best training, the most money, the best technology. We have all that. The reason we don't win wars is because we have a low strategic IQ. And we need to increase our strategic IQ. Now, the good news is it's not hard to do that. It's not like we, you know, have to, you know, invest in $30 trillion. We can do this. We can get smart on this. We shouldn't have to take a World War I, you know, failure to get smart, because we should not forget that even an undefeated military can lose. We can get smart now. And I offer 10 new rules of war that can be used in any combination to win modern wars, and that war is winnable. And those who just throw up their hands and say, "War, modern war is too complicated, we should just give up, we should just be reactionary," those are the quitters, and we should not succumb to quitting. We should get ahead of this, learn how war has changed, and change with it, and then master it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about the new rules of war, victory in the age of durable disorder, Sean. And also, I really highly promote our listeners to read the book. You know, some will love it, some might not like it, but the thing is, it really makes you think about the current situation and the future, and that's what we need to do, because the more thought process we put into everything, hopefully we have better outcomes. So thank you so much, Sean, and spending the time with us on the Loopcast.
Thanks, Chelsea. It's always a pleasure to be back.